And I'm going to, you know, it's a whole story in itself. I'm just going to be skipping some steps, but I'm going to try and skip the minimal number of steps. And I'm trying to build around the calculation that we did last time. So I just want to remind you how the normalization was going to go in just a little bit more detail because I'd like to move it there. So we had our original Lagrangian for QED was minus 1/4, what I'm going to call the bare. Fields, because remember we're normalizing them. Psi bare q slash plus mass to call n bare minus ie or plus ie again to my side. Q slash bare psi bare. So then the precise way I want to normalize things is I want to define a bare mu to be then 3 to 1 half a have psi bear going to be then 2 to 1 half psi. M bear, I'm going to call it the mass minus delta m. And E bear, I lied to you about this. Eventually, because you know that there's some of these things are related to one another. So I could have just written the Z1, which is what I did before, but these factors are there because so the motivation, this is just a convention, right? So, and the motivation for it is that in the end of the day, gauge invariance is going to say that combination d mu plus I e bear a bear mu is going to be the same thing as d mu plus I e a mu. And so that means that that's going to be true because what's going to happen is that this factor here, gauge invariance is requiring this to be true. And so gauge invariance is going to require Z1 to be equal to Z2. And so in the end of the day, you can see that E is being scaled by Z3 to minus 1 half, which is going to exactly cancel the scaling of A. So is required gauge invariance with anyone equals that too. And this is normally done for you in electrodynamics in a long Ward identities story where they talk about that as a bunch of identities that the propagators and the vertices all have to satisfy, which follows from gauge invariance. And then you derive this thing. But it's been morally the same argument. I mean, more or less, you're saying that gauge invariance is restricting how the gauge field appears in the answer. And that's true with amplitude of the quantum correction as well as the for it. So that's one of the steps I'm skipping a detailed story about. But it's true nonetheless. So Z3, knowing what Z3 is what we're going to get from our vacuum polarization is going to be sufficient to tell us what E does, which is where we want to go for the Arminian patterns. Now, so we had, I guess I can write it here. So we had, so if I write this is being all not well interaction, our original Lagrangian, where I express L naught as being the free thing involving these real fields, not the bare fields. So I'm not going to say minus 1/4 F mu, F mu, minus psi bar, psi, M, psi. It's just a matter of if you plug in those things and you have the re-expression of the Lagrangian in terms of these various quantities M, A, E, and psi, just subtract that, and what's left is L interaction. Right? And that's how you read off of these kinds of contracts. So the L interaction becomes, what we're doing is reorganizing for a wave theory a little bit because we're taking into account the fact that once we perturb things, we wanted to have the unperturbed interactions be described by weakly interacting particles whose mass was actually the unperturbed physical mass. The normalizations were the ones that were canonical.
Can we do this? Are we rearranging the order in an infinite sum? Do you know what I mean? Like, if we have anything that's going to be
sort of order of summations again?
Yeah. This is every time.
So you're thinking that these sums are going to converge. It's worse than that. The sums we're writing down there are actually only asymptotic series to the, you know, when we talk about cross sections of it. Because there's a really good argument that the answer doesn't converge, that it's not analytic in the constant plane. There's a physical argument along the lines of if you change alpha to minus alpha, then you know, all your bounds need to go away, your coupling constant is imaginary, and you know that things cannot be physically drastic things happen when you change the sign of alpha. So that means that there's not a disk in the complex alpha plane in which a series is converging, which is what you would have if you have to converge the series. So you know that zero is not a nice place in the complex plane to expand around. And so that's basically the problem. There's no way you're going to get a convergence. Your radius of convergence around zero is going to be zero. It's not nice. But you don't care because all you really need to do is all you're really using when you compare this experiment, and if you compare the QED result for G minus 2, you get 10 best places of agreement with the experiment. That's because you didn't care that the whole thing was converging. All you cared about was that asymptotically is the coupling became small, the difference between the answer and what you got was going to zero, times the power of E. And so that says that if you, at some point, because it doesn't converge, at some point what will happen is that for fixed times, so since that's an asymptotic story, but the coupling constant is going to zero, if you take the finite value of E, if you're going to learn it's 0.3 or something experimentally, for some fixed numerical value, what will happen is that the error between the real result and your series is going to get smaller and smaller at some point, and then it's going to start to grow again because the series isn't really converging. And that point will be set by the size of your coupling. The smaller the coupling is, the farther down the series that'll happen. So, if alpha is 1 over 100, then it's going to happen way down the series, but if alpha is a third or something, it's going to happen in the first few turns. And so in practice, that means you're always talking about a finite. It's not an infinite series, it's a finite series that you're talking about. Then all those limitations never arrive. So the L interaction becomes, what we had before, minus IV sidebar A slash psi, plus what is called the counter term of the Rhine, which are all to do with these renormalizations and the change from E fair to E and M fair to M. This is the thing that is, that's minus 1/4, and take minus 1, and zero, minus 2/1, r, slash, plus that 2m, upper side, drawing these, you know, so this particular vertex was the one I drew when I drew something like this. So it was an insertion along the photon line. And this would be two different kinds of insertions along the fermion line where you have something like that. And there's two different kinds depending on whether that you're keeping. You can group this one if you like with that one. Then this one would be a new vertex of the form of the basic, the basic vertex of the problem was like that. We have also a new one, which is along the lines of right like that. A counterterm. So that's the logic of it. And the statement that it's a renormalizable theory is a statement that by adjusting, by properly adjusting these coefficients, the cutoff dependence drops out of that. And when you re-express, if you calculate physical quantities in terms of E, M, and energies and things like that, you're going to get an answer which is independent of your ultraviolet cutoff, and the limit that the cutoff is large, by appropriately choosing these things. And that and nothing more than these things. So that the things, you're never going to need something involving, three or four photons appearing at a certain point to get rid of these divergences, is the statement for normalizability. It's also, So far, so good. So then we did this calculation of, in particular, this is one I want to focus on. So the Feynman rule for that is going to be, is that, you know, it's minus I, pi to the four of, if there's momentum, p coming in, let's say it's q coming in, q going out. It's, so it's q1, I guess, q1, q2. So we know we had to have that, and then we have a factor of 3 minus 1 times q1 squared a to b. And those q's are coming in because of the derivatives that are appearing, the derivative computation that's appearing there. So now we've calculated, so if we calculate the, in this graph, what we did last time was we calculated, we calculated this plus this plus this counter-trend thing. And the difference between this and this, I lumped into this vacuum polarization, find me new, Q, where Q is the momentum flowing through this thing. So let me write just kind of where we got with that. So what we found is that pi mu nu had this expression. I'm going to know everything's regularized. I'm going to cut and chase to what the answer was. So it was q squared if you knew. Minus q mu, q mu, since it's on a function q, times pi of q squared. And I'm going to explicitly write the dimension of space-time here, and just because I want to follow that variable. So the difference between this pi and this pi is that there's no mu nu. So that the tensor structure mu nu was all had this form, and I told you that that was a great thing because gauge invariance required q mu and this thing to be zero. And it was zero, the dimension regularization. That was a sign that all gauge invariance was working. That's going to be obviously crucial if we're going to try and absorb a divergence into this one counterterm, because this one counterterm we had to work with had that same tensor structure. So the fact that we have a counterterm which looks like what we got is a good sign, and we wouldn't have had that if we had had a, if we'd used a cutoff, for instance, rather than dimensional regularization, we would have had a separate coefficient of these two terms, which would have meant we would have needed a counterterm which was not just like this. You need a thing like a mass term for the photon as well to normalize the extra term. So it's gauge invariance is playing a role for us here, in that we're only writing down gauge invariant things in this action because our action is gauge invariance. And so it's important that the quantum corrections have the same structure. You know that that's not automatic, right? Because we know that symmetry survives quantization when there's no anomalies. And so that's why anomalies would, this is one of the concrete ways in which anomalies would have been a problem. If you had a, if the standard model had anomalies, you try to do the same story, you would have found that the kinds of things you can write down as counterterms are restricted by gauge invariance, but you'd find that the one loop counter, the entire loop calculation you do, wouldn't necessarily have that same tensor structure. So the divergences in them couldn't be absorbed into the normalizations that came from your original Lagrange. Now pi, we have an explicit formula for. Pi q squared n, well that's minus, here I lied to you, it's also a little bit, so let's write the proper formula. Plus alpha minus 2. Pi squared. The tan of 2 minus n over 2. There we go. This is the Feynman parameter. Yep. X. X of n squared. Mu squared, remember, was this dimensionless. We defined e here. Again, we defined by this e that's appearing here got replaced by e mu to the 4 minus n, right? I'm doing it from memory, so I can't remember if that's what I told before, but whatever I told before was right. So we did that to make before we figured out. So this is the dimension of boson has dimension of the Lagrangian has dimensions n. We take two derivatives off for the kinetic term, we have n minus two, and so the boson has half that dimension. Fermion Lagrangian is I bar d slash psi, so the Lagrangian is dimension n. You subtract one derivative for the d slash, then half of that will be the dimension of the Fermion field, and we got two of them. So the dimension of this, these three things is this. So that's n. N over 2 is 3, n over 2, minus 1, minus 1, minus 2. The whole Lagrangian is supposed to have dimensions n. So E has to have dimensions of n minus 3, n over 2, minus 2, which on this right should be 2. So n minus 3, n over 2 would be minus n over 2, right? 2 minus n over 2. That's wrong. So that's the dimension of E, so we want mu to the 2 times n over 2. It's often, because n is appearing negatively everywhere, it's often convenient to write n is 4 minus 2 times epsilon. And then you think of epsilon going to 0 as being the limit to n goes to 4. And this 2 is convenient, the minus 2 is convenient because it makes these things very simple. So this becomes, in this case, just epsilon. So you can also write this as being E in the epsilon. And because this thing is there, that's there, that's kind of where it just came from. So if I've done this right, dimensions seem funny now. That's where that came from. So now the next thing is n is arbitrary there. We want to take epsilon to 0. Problem is, when we do that, the thing diverges. And it diverges because as n goes to 4, we get a gamma of 0 here, which has a pole. So that's going to be a problem. It's going to keep us from going for any positive, even integer n. We're going to have that pole. So what we're supposed to do is a right expansion. Around n equals 4, which would be epsilon equals 0. This epsilon is not the epsilon in the minus I epsilon of the pole. So we're all clear. And so let me just, the class of things that we're expanding that way have the form. If you're interested in let's call it curly I of n, we had to form gamma of 4 minus n minus capital D over 2 and some function of n. This D I'm putting in because D is 0 here in our example, but there was another in the intermediate step along the way here, we once had the case D equals 2 here because we both a quadratic. D is kind of the, if you had cut the integral off, what would your divergence be? If d is 0, it's logarithmic. If d is 2, it would have been quadratic and then cut off, so on. So this is kind of the form in which we're interested in, where we're interested in d equals 0 here. We could have been interested in d equals 2. But in the Lorentz series, you know, we know that gamma of x near x equals 0, I did this for you last time, it's 1 over x minus the Euler Mascherelli constant plus over x. So we expand out. You know, can expand f, can expand this thing, and I of n near n equals 0 becomes, you know, 2 over 4 minus n times f of 4 minus gamma f of 4 minus twice f prime of 4 plus order n minus 4. So this is the pole part at n equals 4, and this is the finite part. And then this vanishes when it goes to 4. And you can see you're getting two contributions here. One of them is the expansion of this thing, keeping this contribution in the expansion of this thing, which is subdominant compared to the first one. That's that finite piece. And then you also have a Taylor expansion of this thing, the linear order in n minus 4. And that multiplies the pole here, you get to infinite. That's where this term came from. So it's this one over, it's this term hitting the order n minus 4 term there, which indicated that. And in our case, we had, hypothetically speaking, let's say we just done a vacuum polarization calculation, and then we had the f was equal to I pi to the n over 2 gamma of a plus n over 2 m squared to the a plus b n over 2 multiplied m over n over 2 gamma b. That's the actual thing we were looking at for various choices of a and b. Then in that series, what we have is f of 4 just becomes I pi squared gamma of a plus 2 m squared to the b. M2 is just 1. And M prime of 4 is I pi squared turns up to 4 times sine of a plus 2 times sine of 2. Don't have the logarithm of my m squared, where psi of x is just the logarithm, it's defined to be dx of logarithm of gamma of x, which is gamma prime of x over gamma of x. So we know what that is. Now it's conventional, so you need some sort of a condition. The problem with subtracting infinities from things is that you don't have an unambiguous definition of what the finite part is, right? So I could, if we call this the full part, then this is the finite part. But if I call this minus 6 the full part, it still diverges. And then I change the finite part. So you have to have some sort of a criterion for defining what you meant by the finite part once you've subtracted it. And that criterion is called the renormalization prescription. You want to define exactly how you're separating the infinite and the finite parts from one another. And it's up to you how you do it. You can choose whatever you like. And it's useful. So there's two approaches people use. In their choice of renormalization prescription, they either choose something which is mathematically convenient, like full part. So one what's called minimal subtraction would be to choose to call what you just get here in dimensional regularization is the infinite part, and this is the finite part, and that's the answer. So that's a conveniently, calculationally convenient choice. But you don't have any commitment to that if we ask, let me actually make one more statement for it. I'm one step ahead of myself. So the thing is that we've done this, we're trying to calculate this plus this, and the point is that when we add this plus this, what's happening is that this is going to combine with this. And this depends on q squared. This does. Once I factor this out, which is a common factor. So if I call this is graph star, and star plus star it gives me something along the lines of squared mu minus q nu I q squared in n plus then 3 minus 1. And so we're free to choose this to cancel the infinite part of this, but now the words of the federal normalization scheme come in. How much do you cancel? Do you just cancel the pole, or do you cancel the pole and 6, or do we cancel the pole and this annoying gamma term all the time, or what do you do? So it's just up to you how you do it. And the two broad classes of choice are just calculation convenience, where you choose this to do something like cancel the pole. But you're not really saying, once you've done that you've made some sort of a physical choice for the normalization of the A over there. Because you just really have defined Z to be in some arbitrary calculation way. The second choice you could use is you could use a physical criterion for Z, and you could say, how do I want to normalize my field? And define it there as being a renormalization of this field A. And so I could ask something physical, like the residue of the pole of the propagator at the singularity is 1, or if I'm talking with a coupling constant, I could ask something like, this is the charge that I measure when I do scattering of electrons at a Picker energy, a Picker angle, and that's how I'm going to, that's the physical charge I'm going to mean. And so something like that is called a physical renormalization scheme. It means that you're going to calculate some specific thing, like the propagator and ask for its residue, or like the scattering amplitude, you know, like the ones we're calculating, and ask for the and define the scattering amplitude to be equal to the charge. And then once you do that, that might involve the choice you're making here. It might be that this thing not only cancels the infinite part, but part of the finite part as well, because whatever your physical criterion is for what this thing is, whatever the counter term was, you're asking for a specific thing to be equal to 1 or equal to some specific answer. And that choice might involve canceling more of this pole part. So the definition of how much. So let's see the second stage. First statement is z minus, you know, z minus 1 is going to cancel the infinite part. Statement 1 is it's chosen cancel the infinite part. And do that no matter how you regularize it. That's kind of the good thing. Then pending how Z3 is defined, it can also cancel part of the product. That doesn't mean it, there's no content here, because you can't cancel the Q squared thing. So that's where your question is now. All you can do here is fool around with the constant part of this, but once you've done that, the Q squared dependence is something which has to be finite. It's just something which is a prediction. So this is called a normalization scheme. So common examples are minimal subtraction, which is defined if you just cancel the pole. That's only the 1 over n minus 4 term. There's also what's called modified minimal subtraction. This is actually what's useful in talking. And that says, cancel the pole and this other crap here. Like, you know, why carry that around if you don't need it? And exactly which, I can't remember off the top of my head exactly how much this crap would cancel, but it's all I can say for now is cancel pole and plus the minus gamma term, and possibly a few others for convenience. And a physical scheme right, it's the next board. Oh, I forgot to put that. I said a lie at some point and I didn't follow up on that. The lie was alpha. Before, alpha came in because 2 to the alpha was trace of I. And I think I called that 2 to the d over 2 last time, right? You look at your nose, 2 to the n over 2. So I think in last class I was writing, this is the Dirac matrix in n dimensions, the unit matrix. So this is really the number of components in the spinner in n dimensions. I think I wrote that this was 2 to the n over 2. You should check your notes if I did that. If I did, that's wrong. That's true in even numbers of dimensions, that's true. In odd numbers of dimensions, it's not true. If you have a spinner in 4 dimensions has 4 components. But in 5 dimensions, you still have 4 components, because here the gamma matrices you had were gamma mu was, you know, gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, and gamma 3. But we also have matrix gamma 5, which commuted n commuted to them all, and squared to 1. So if I want to represent the algebra, the Dirac algebra, gamma mu m nu is equal to twice a mu nu in five dimensions, I can do it for free. I can just, this is now gamma 4. So the size of the spinner, the representation of these things are the same in an odd dimension as it was in one less even dimension. And again, you just, the thing that separated, in even dimensions, you can always separate a left and a right-handed spinner using this matrix, gamma 5. And then you can just, in the next highest dimension, you can always just use that gamma 5 as another gamma matrix. But you no longer can separate left and right-handed spinners because this is now just one of the gammas for one of the space dimensions. So this is true with n's even. You might have worried what would happen if n was odd here. So what happens if it's n, if alpha is n over 2, if n is even, but it's n minus 1 over 2, if n is odd. That's the one kicker that I gave you a wrong statement for that was there. That's the only change in this whole thing. So this is any smooth function. In general, it's any smooth function which does this when you evaluate it as integers. That's all you have to know. Now, physical renormalization scheme could be, you know, find delta M by asking M be the visible mass. See, I could have defined delta M over there, the renormalization of the mass, this thing here. Nothing says I have to make M the physical mass. If I'm using minimal subtraction, the answer I get is going to be something. It's not going to necessarily tell you that the M that you're left with finite is a physical mass. But I could instead define this kind of term to be such that this thing is the one you measure when you measure the mass of the electron. Or you might measure, or E is the charge of the electron measured in Coulomb scattering at low energies, and say and some energy E equals star fixed angle. So if you kind of specify exactly some kinematic regime and you measure the scattering amplitude, you could say, well, if for low energies that should look like Coulomb scattering, it should look like E squared over Q squared in momentum phase. And so in low energies, if it starts to asymptotically look like E squared or Q squared, I'll call a coefficient on top E squared. That would be my definition thing. So something like that could be how you define E. Or if you define Z3, what we're going to do, the physical choice of Z3 is chosen so that I Q squared equals 0 for all n is 0. That corresponds to, that's similar to the choice that you would have made, but the choice for Z2 would be that the residue of the propagator for the fermion is 1. So for Z2 is chosen so that the time ordered product of psi of x, psi bar of y, I guess let's do this 0. Integral pdi px d3x. So if Fourier transform this, that goes like, you know, minus I p slash plus m over p squared plus m squared times some coefficient. I could have had some coefficient c, but I'm going to say that coefficient is 1 as p squared plus m squared goes to 0. So that's the residue statement. There's no, it's not 6 times this, it's 1 times this. If you take, this thing as a function of momentum, it always has a pole when p squared goes to m squared. And so you're just asking for the coefficient to be the one that you would have gotten from an interactive theory, basically. So those are the kind of choices that you could make as a physical choice. And I'm going to use for Z3 this one. This is the one that is the standard choice for photons. For reasons it's kind of takes us a little bit further field to get into, and it's not really so important. So with that choice, you can see what you have to do. All you have to do is, whatever it's written down here now, You see that this choice tells me exactly what I'm supposed to do with Z3. Z3 minus 1 is equal to minus pi at Q squared equals 0 for any n, and then I'll evaluate that at n equals 4. So, that choice says Z3 then becomes Z3 minus 1. Where that choice becomes, I can read it off knowing what phi is, and I'm gonna do this. So the idea is that I'm going to evaluate this at as n goes to 4 after the cancellation. So it's I'm going to write down for you here what the expression is where I've done all that. So that's so Z3 is 1 t squared over 12 times squared. 1 over 2 minus n over 2 minus gamma minus logarithm squared over n squared. It's useful to know this thing, so not only do it on the side, what would we have gotten? Using a cutoff. So multiply the cutoff, lambda. There would have been a complication that the answer wouldn't have been gauge invariance, but I would have had to choose counter terms to make a gauge invariant. So I could choose. If I allowed my non-gauge invariant counter terms, I would have not had just f mu f nu. I would have had, d mu a nu, d mu a nu. I would have had d mu a nu, d nu a nu. All the things I worked down for vectors, I would have had a master on a mu a nu. I would have had a counter term for all of them in my Lagrangian. And then I would have asked them to cancel all the things in my integrals which were not gauge invariant to give me a gauge invariant answer. And once I'd done that, the coefficient, the answer would have been proportional to q mu, q nu minus q squared eta mu, which I wrote down here somewhere, probably erased by now. And then I could have asked, how does that, that's at the top for there. And I could ask, how does that, how big would Z3 minus 1 have been in that case? And you can read it off correctly by using a trick. And the trick is that this pi here has the property that if you did the, or here I've done the integral already. If I go back one step and look at the integrals when I still had integrals over the loop momenta in them, you remember that this is something which was dimensionless, and so it was logarithmically divergent if you go back and look at what we had as an integral there. So if we take dDQ squared of it, then, or dDM squared of it, or dD any mass scale of it, the integral that we would have been left would have been convergent. And so its answer is the same in dimensional organization as it is in cutoff or anything. So the idea is that if, since the original loop integral, the integral d4 L or whatever it was, I guess they called it R, of something. But something here, I guess the integrand depended on r squared, q squared, and m squared. And these appeared through the combination capital M squared. Remember, capital M squared was little m squared plus x, 1 minus x, q squared. This thing diverged logarithmically. If I cut it off, lambda logarithmically. That means that differentiating with like the q squared or m squared makes it converge. I'll do m squared. So I'll do m squared dm squared of the integral. convergence. So if I calculate what Z3 minus 1 is, I'm going to get some answer in the logarithmic in the cutoff case. But it means that if I calculate m squared dz3 dm squared, that's something which has to be converging. And so that's something which has to be the same no matter how I regularize the integral. Is u v finite. And so must free for the cutoff case and the dimensionally regularized case. Because remember, we asked all our regularizations to satisfy this reasonableness criteria, that if you took the difference of two integrands, then if the integral of the difference was the integral of the difference of the integrands. And and we also asked that a regularized expression for a convergent integral was just whatever you got by integrating, getting into the integral. So that's going to guarantee that no matter how we regularize things, this particular combination is the same. And we can just calculate what it is in dimensional regularization because it's right in front of us here. So it's got to be equal to something next order. You know that m squared dz3 the m squared is just given by the log. It's the only thing that depends on m squared, right? So we're going to get the logarithm will give us 1 over m squared. Then we multiply by m squared, and that just kills it, gives us 1. So we're going to get plus p squared over 12 pi squared. And that means that if we now integrate that in a cutoff. So then now what we know is that this, in the case of using a cutoff, whatever the answer was, it gave us this. Cutoff case, we knew this thing was diverging logarithmically, right? So we knew that Z3 was some coefficient, you know, C, and the logarithm of lambda squared over m squared plus pi. So if we just do the same thing, m squared, you know, dz3 m squared, it's just going to be minus c, right? So that just comparing them tells us that c is minus c squared over 12 pi squared. So we know that in the case of a cutoff, it would have had z3 was minus c squared over 12 pi squared, log of lambda squared over m squared, plus subdominant in lambda. And you can also derive that by going back to the original integral and cutting it off and dimensionally regularizing it. So then you can take the limits separately and see what happens. So, let's make sure that sign is right, because the sign is very important. In fact, this is not Z3, this is Z3 minus 1 is the thing I want. That's the thing we're following around as a counter term. I'm going to write it that way. And that's the right sign, too. So there's a cartoon. I'm going to give you a cartoon of a story now. That is, so what does this mean? There's a physical picture that if you stick a charge here, now let's say we have a charge distribution, and this distance here is lambda inverse. So that's the ultraviolet cutoff. We don't know what's inside that. This pi mu of is a function of q squared is a Fourier transform of something in position space. And that thing in position space is very much like a polarization. It literally is like a polarization. It's called a vacuum polarization because it literally appears in Max's equation the way that a polarization tensor would have done. So it's describing a charge separation in the vacuum, a virtual one, to do with electron positive front pairs, which partially screens this charge. And so you get a charge distribution, effective charge distribution in here. Say this is a negative charge. You've got kind of positive charges like to come towards the negative charge, and negative charges get moved away from it. And so there's an effective charge distribution that you see in the vacuum, which extends out, I'll show you in a second, out a distance of the order of m inverse due to electron the fact that electrons can be, virtual electrons can polarize back to the vacuum. And the charge that you see at infinity is kind of a combination of the charge here and the polarization cloud. And that can be made very precise by taking our function for pi. So once we've made the choice of this choice here for Z3, we can go back to our vacuum polarization up there, pi. What we've arranged is that pi of q squared vanishes when q squared is equal to zero. And now we can go back and ask, you know, in our original question, what happens when two charges scatter? You know, we can ask as a function of the q that's being transferred here, if we take q squared to go, so q mu, to go to zero in the time direction, and, you know, vector q in the space direction, which corresponds to no energy. If q here is the energy transfer, this was p, and this is p prime, q is p prime minus p. So it's the energy transferred in the scatter. And if you go to the limit where it's elastic scattering, so there's no energy, this is the four momentum scattering. If you ask for no energy transfer, but just momentum transfer, like scattering from a potential, then in the limit of small momentum transfer, this should become the Coulomb scattering potential. That's where you can start. And if you define the charge to be the charge whose Coulomb scattering reproduces this full answer as a function of q squared, that's a way of very precisely pinning down what this charge distribution is that we're not talking about here. So given a charge, a bunch of charges qi, say, the charge distribution, we don't know what these charge distributions are inside here, but let's say it's equal to qi of the delta function of say, r minus the position of the charge i, plus, I'm going to call it eta of r minus position of the charge i. And this eta is the result of the vacuum polarization of the electron. What I'm saying now is that I'm skipping a bunch of steps. The logic of it, which I can give you notes on or you can work them with yourself, is that if I take the amplitude calculated, look at the limit that there's no energy transfer, so that these energies are the same as over these, but there is a very non-zero but small momentum transfer, then this thing should look like scattering from a potential, a Coulomb potential. The Coulomb potential, you know, in position space is, you know, goes like charge squared, the charge squared divided by r. But in momentum space, that becomes you know, charge squared divided by q squared. So if we look for this thing in a small q squared limit, it should look like this. But it's going to have some more complicated q squared dependence because we know that this thing has a q squared dependence. And so the vacuum, the renormalization we did for Z3 takes care of the constant part here, but we have a q-squared dependence, and that's something that's saying something physical about what the vacuum's doing. And so that q-squared dependence, which you can read off from this calculation, if you compare it to the potential energy that you were scattering from and go back to position space, you can read off what the corresponding charge density would have been. Okay? Those are the steps that I'm going to give you the answer for. And so I'm going to write down what eta is here. But the important thing is it's clear for you guys what I'm doing here. It's because I'm skipping steps. I want you to be able to follow the logic of it. And you can zero out my notes if you like here. It's also, I think, in probably my notes book somewhere because I'm taking this from the lectures, my lecture notes in that course. So the statement is, let me make sure I'm defining it. I'm going to define it that way. So that's the way I'm going to define eta. And so the definition of the charge would be what you see at infinity. So I have to define, I have to require that eta satisfies the integral d3x or d3r of eta is equal to zero. That's the statement that I'm not adding any charge. This is polarizing the vacuum. It's not adding charges to the vacuum. The polarization is significant because it means that if you're going to ask how much charge is in a circle of a given radius, you're going to get a different answer because you're getting a separation of charge here, which is totally electrically neutral, but if you only look at part of it, you're going to see the charge inside the smallest sphere seem to change because you've excluded some charge outside here. And so what you see physically on the outside will be the charge outside this whole distribution, which turns out to be the quantum wavelength electron in size. And the bare charge would be the charge you start off with on the inside. And so the running of the charge, if you like, is to do with how this distribution changes as you change, as you kind of sweep the size of what you think the source is in your mind through this polarization cloud of electrons. So this is the statement that that polarization cloud is electrically neutral. It has to be, because you're not adding any charges at the end of the day. So using the previous expression for I q squared, you can read out what eta is, and eta turns out to be, and it's not a short calculation. But it's a structure. You should do it. Let me give you a couple intermediate steps. Now let me just tell you the answer. So eta is. So it's an integration constant that you're not going to know, kind of a delta function, whose purpose is just to build that in. Minus e squared over h pi squared r squared, r cubed, h pi cubed. Integral from 0 to 1. The pi that we're using has this Feynman parameter integral in it, right? So that's still there. I still haven't done the integral. Of 1 plus the mass times r over the square root of x, 1 minus x, minus x, minus x, e, minus, minus r divided by the square root. So that's an integral you can do in principle over x, although it's just kind of a supplementary form. But the asymptotic forms are, for large r and small r, are eta goes to 0 for r much bigger than n degrees. And if r is much less than n degrees, then eta is approximately n times the delta function minus squared over 38 pi. That's kind of how this fits. Now the condition that this condition here, that it's a polarization cloud and not something else, says you kind of see why that integral is, the exponential is killing off the integrand very quickly once MR becomes large. That's why the whole thing is dying off with size 1 over m. So the condition that integral d3r of a equals 0 tells you what n is. It says that n is given by this, doing the integral there. And the integral there is going to be involving the integral d3r over r cubed. And for small r, d3r over r cubed diverges logarithmically, right? Because you've got d3r and the bottom fit r cubed. And so as r goes to 0, you're getting a divergence which is logarithmic, which is the same, that's there for the same reason that we were always finding things that were diverging logarithmically for large cubed. So, and the check on the whole thing is that the divergence, if we cut off that divergence at a small distance lambda inverse, we're going to get the same coefficient here as I got the momentum space, as you kind of had to, because this is all derived from the same function pi. So n becomes the divergent part of it becomes integral lambda inverse P3R of this small square root 3 R cubed. So that's fine. So that's becomes D square root of 4 pi squared log of lambda squared root of m squared. Because if I made this lambda round, that would be a factor of 2 here, which would be 12, and you recognize it's the same thing as there. And you compare this to z minus 1, you know, there's a total charge. So the total bare charge, in this case, is what's in front of the delta function, so that's the q. Sorry, the total real charge is q. Q is equal to the total physical charge. That's what this condition means. For the bare charge, how much charge you have inside this little circle of order, whatever's inside there would be the bare charge. That's going to be the sum of q plus this delta function. This delta function lives inside that circle. So the bare charge would be q plus n. And so given that expression for n, and the definition of what we meant by z. So this is q bare is e bare times some number. So that's actually z3 minus 1 half q. So comparing this to this, so allows you to read off when z3 is z3 minus 1 is, and that says that it's the same thing as we defined. It's 1 plus, so z3 is 1 plus n to the minus 2, that becomes 1 minus p squared over 12 pi squared log of lambda squared over m squared. So I want to believe this actually is squared, which is what we got on here. So the thing is, it hangs together. And the vacuum solenoid is really telling you there's a polarization there in a very physical way with a very physical profile. It extends out as far as the constant wavelength of the particle that's involved, whose virtual effects were in that loop, in that circle, in the final graph over there. And the physical renormalization, the interpretation of renormalization is that as you distort the vacuum, positive charges come in, negative ones go out, but if you impose a cutoff, then positive charges are going to trickle across the line where you make your cutoff. And although the total vacuum energy from zero to infinity, the total polarization was electrically neutral, once you cut things off, some of that separation of charge trickles in past your cutoff, and that's what makes the charge appear to change in scale as you physically define how big your charge distribution is. So what you're expecting is the charge will, if you measure charge on scales smaller than 1 over m, how big you get will depend on how big you decide your charge, how big you decide your electron was, or what you thought your cutoff was. So the polarized charge, polarization charge trickles over. To make effective charge, to make Q bare differ from Q. Which would have been puzzling. If you think the polarization, you're not screening charge with, if polarization is always a neutral effect. It's just moving charges around, you're not adding. So it might have bothered you that by polarizing the vacuum, you've actually changed the charge. It's only because you're excluding some region from what you're allowed to look at it. So you're pushing the polarization in and out past to the region you've excluded with your cutoff. So that's supposed to set you up for. So the upside is that the vacuum polarization implies that if a physical charge is defined carefully, regularized theory in terms of a physical quantity. So that could be a scattering amplitude like this one was, or it could be some other thing. We're going to need a verb in that sentence soon. Find it then. It implicitly involves a scale. Which is often called the renormalization point. So it could be that you're going to take Coulomb scattering at some small but non-zero momentum transfer. It can't be zero because the whole thing is only 1 over q squared. So you might take q squared to be, you know, 0.003 or something. But you're going to have to choose something and measure the amplitude at that point. And that means that your implicit definition of what your charge is depends on that choice you make. And so you, even though you're not normally writing, you're thinking of the charge as being dimensionless, say, once you're forced to physically define it, it carries an implicit scale. Another scale that enters is the cutoff, if you have a cutoff. But that's a scale that is only entering as you regularize things. So if you look at a regularized expression, then things will have cutoffs in them. If you ask for the counterterm necessary to produce, so there's I want to make a distinction between several things. So if we regularize everything, then amplitudes depend on how you regularize it, on how you regularize things like lambda. Renormalized things, by definition, never depend on how you regularize them. Renormalized things will be physical quantities that you've chosen to express in terms of other physical quantities. But they depend on how you define them. So renormalized things depend on the renormalization scale. And if you ask for a counterterm, which is how you take a regularized expression to make a renormalized thing, it's going to depend on both of those things. It typically depend on the cutoff or how you regularize things and on how you define your renormalized quantity. So counterterm depends on both. And it's important to keep those distinctions in mind because people tend to forget the renormalization part of things, and they talk about a cutoff as if it's a physical thing. And they talk about, people tend to mix regularization with renormalization in a very loose way of speaking, which is confusing if you're not clear on that there's a really separation of issues here. The point of this is that we should now be expecting things like charges to depend on exactly the scales on which we define them. And so that's the statement that charges run. That if I measure charges in a particular way, the value that I get will depend on exactly how I define the charge that I was measuring. Said that way, it sounds like it's how could that not be true? And one way you could have defined a charge is you could have said, well, I'm going to say all the charge is in some fixed size, and it's up to you what the size is. And then this polarization thing shows you how that's going to depend on how the charge physically depending on the size you choose, because you're including or not including some of the polarization of the vacuum, the polarization of the charge of the vacuum, depending on how the scale at which you define the charge compares with the scale of the electron mass. And so the running a coupling is just tracking that. It's just a question of how you solve things. And so if someone asks you, how does this charge run, or coupling run, they have to tell you several things. They have to tell you, in particular, how they define it. So there were various schemes we could have used. We could have used minimal subtraction. We could have used modified minimal subtraction. We could have used a physical definition. And in general, how things run depends on how you define it. So it's really a few of how you choose definitions. So in general, let's say the physical terms are E, and the scale, let's call it mu r, for renormalization point. In general, E is a function of mu. Depends on the normalization scheme chosen. You might say, well, where is this in minimal subtraction? It seems like there's no scale there, right? If there's minimal subtraction, you just subtract the pole. No dimensions of the pole. So one puzzle might be, how do you get the scale out of a minimal subtraction? And the way the scale comes in is through this scale. I hope I haven't erased already. I'll probably write it down. It's up there. You can kind of see that if I subtract out the pole and the gamma thing, I'm left with something. You can see it only in Z3 minus 1 here, but you're left with a mu squared that came from dimensional regularization. And so in minimal subtraction, the scale that comes in naturally is this dimensional scale mu squared. Or if you didn't want to make mu explicit, it would be the scale that's in the charge itself if you're in n dimensions. So so in this case, it is the scale of the rho e went e mu to the 2 minus n over 2. So, for example, if you said that, so we said that the definition of the bare charge was Z3 minus 1/2 of the normalized charge. That was how we started the whole story, right? So that says that the normalized charge is Z3 to 1/2 times the bare charge. This thing diverges. No matter how you regulate things, this thing was designed not to diverge. It's funny. So this thing has to be divergent too. And in this case, we actually know explicitly how this goes, right? This is e sub b times z3. We have that written down over here. It's this. So z3 minus 1 would be this. Square root, preferably, I can write it just being a half times. That's the bb. I don't want to write this. Z3 minus 1 minus e squared multiplied squared log of lambda squared over r squared plus finite sum. So this would be e sub b 1 minus e squared over 24 pi squared log of lambda squared r squared. Or we could have equally well written it. Maybe I should do this in poles. It might be a method. Everything I'm saying I could have done with a pole here rather than a log. How I regularize is not important. Because what I'm going to prove to you now is I'm going to try and follow how E depends on scales. So let me actually do it with a pole. I want to do this. I'm doing minimal case. Let's do the pole. So Z3. I think it's still up there, right? It's 1. It's 1 minus there's a constant that I don't care about, and I want to just follow the mu squared. So there's a plus or minus. So minus lambda squared minus log. So if I combine these, this is e sub bare minus keeping on the terms that are order e squared when I go from this z minus 1 to z minus 1. It's also true that e sub b and e differ by things that are e squared, so I can think of this being e sub b squared or e squared or whatever I like. So the point of the exercise is, I can think of this as defining what I mean by, these words means that I should think of this as defining, this is something that didn't depend on mu. I'm getting a mu squared dependence because of the mu squared dependence that I got when I did minimal subtraction. So if I ask for how e changes for different values of mu, if I do this for different, mu sub naught, let's say, same formula. all the changes that I evaluated are commutative. So the difference between them is something that doesn't depend on regularization anymore. Probably a better way to do this is to actually screw this thing on the other way in a second. So I take the difference that cancels, that C cancels, and I'm just left with plus plus. I'm going to get a minus, I'm going to get plus plus. And for the order we're working, I don't have to keep track of there's been an E and E sub U there. So this is a finite expression. As it had to be, because I'm comparing two finite things. So it had to be true that when I took the difference, the difference would drop out by construction. So this would be the, this in the case of dimensional regularization shows how it's running, depends on the value of U that I decided to use. And there's one last step I want to leave you with is that people very rarely do that. So that looks like that's the end of the story. I told you what, how E depends on mu, but it's useful to find beta of E to be mu dE dmu. And we just differentiated here, right? We do that, we're going to get. So it's important that when I do this, I'm holding E to B fixed, right? And N fixed. So if I do that, I'm going to get plus, plus, minus, so I'll get minus, excuse me, minus e squared over 12 times squared. 12 instead of 24 because it's mu, not mu squared, I'm differentiating. And minus, minus and plus, and then I've got a minus because that's the denominator. Now that doesn't depend on mu, so we can integrate it. So the easiest way to integrate this is to recognize that, so what it says that we got e over e squared is minus 1 over 12 pi squared d mu over mu. So that says that, that 1 over e of mu is equal to 1 over e of mu naught plus 1 over 12 pi squared log mu. Did I do that right? If I've done that right, when this gets bigger, then e is getting smaller. Whereas over here, if that got bigger, e got smaller. Yeah. Now you might say, so that's I've done a very stupid thing. I had a solution, e of mu. I differentiated and I integrated again, and I got a new solution. It's not the same solution. There's either something very deep here or something very stupid here. And there's something, there is something deep here that the domain of validity of this formula is more than the domain of validity of that formula. And this required perturbation theory. It required that everything on the right-hand side was always small, right? And in particular, it required that the e squared times the logarithm of mu squared over mu naught squared was much less than 1. That's what goes into that formula. But this formula doesn't rely on the logarithm part. This just relies on e squared is small. And so does this one. So this one applies, if I solve this for e, right, if I just says that e of mu is e of mu naught. So I multiply through by e of mu, half e of mu naught, and e of mu naught, e of mu, I'll have the product of the two, and subtract, and then divide. So I'll have 1 minus e squared over 12 pi squared log of mu over mu naught. If I've done that right, the sign should work. So it didn't work, so that must be a plus sign. E of mu naught, e of mu. Something happened. Should have done that. That's cubic larger, even smaller. Going to cracking larger type. Mu gets larger, E gets smaller. Mu gets larger, E gets smaller. But if I want to say that if I manipulate this to get this, I would go to minus sign here. No! No, this is right. No, that's right. It's multiplied through by E of mu naught. I have E mu, E mu, so I have a factor, 1 plus log, and I divide by that. Okay, good. So the thing is that this agrees with that when E squared times the logarithm is small, and I can Taylor expand this whole thing. But if the E squared times the logarithm is order 1, but E squared is small, so the logarithm is large, this is still true. So this applies when E squared is much less than 1, even if E squared times the logarithm of E squared over mean not squared is order 1. Larger. And that's why people do this exercise. This is the, called the renormalization group. And it's useful because we set this thing up in a way where our definitions of coupling masses didn't involve any masses. And if we had chosen different, and this is a nice feature of minimal subtraction, that this thing only depends on E squared. If we'd chosen some physical definition of the charge, that one loop would have also depended only on E squared, because that one loop would have been the same. But if we went to five loops, we would have found electron masses on the same one. That would have been more complicated to integrate. So it's a nice feature of these simple schemes that they can be integrated explicitly, and their domain of validity, you learn something for free here, which you wouldn't have gotten by directly taking the expression test for E of mu. And that's why it's useful. These logarithms are useful to follow the answer. The last thing I want to leave you with is that, so in our example here, E goes up. It can go up. I can tell you the opposite, so it's not wrong. E goes up if E goes up. So I'm not going to be I want to give you the right sign, and then I'm going to probably have to find it. Let me at least say it. So Z3 was 1 minus E squared log of lambda squared over M squared. Oh, I know what I did.
Is your logarithm inverted?
My logarithm is inverted. Yeah, I was reading off, cut off, and it's not a mute effect. So it should have been plus. 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 Minus. So now, if E increases, that gets bigger. So we're subtracting more and getting a bigger answer. So E is increasing and mu increases. I want to give you, in general, if we had had, if we'd done, instead of 1 over 12 pi squared, we had a number b here, we would have number b here, we would have number b here, we would have number b here, b squared times b. And so the thing is that the sign of b is what dictates whether or not e goes up or down when mu goes up. And so I want to give you an expression for what b is in a general case. We just calculated it for electromagnetism, but I want to give it to you for the general case that's going to apply to the standard model. Then we can stop. So in general, if we had done for non-abelian gauge group, SU3, or let's say SUN. It has a, with fermions in the fundamental representation. Let's just say in some representation, let's representation given by some matrices TA, then the way we take the trace of TA, TB, that's proportional to delta AB for these groups. And the coefficient is called, it's called the Casimir invariant. And it's characteristic of the representation. So C of R, if you like. And C of R is characteristic of the representation. And I'm going to use, so there's a, it obviously depends on how you normalize these t's. If I scale numbers into the t's, then I'm going to change c. So to nail things down, we use conventions. Scaling the t's, of course, you know, everywhere in the Lagrangian you've got a t, you've got a coupling constant with it. So you have g times t sub a. So scaling the t's is scaling the g. So if I give you a convention of what t is, that's giving you a convention for what I mean by g. So we're going to require that C in the fundamental representation is a half. So that's what we've been using it. For example, for SUN, or SU2, like, let's do SU2, our fundamental representation is just a 2 by 2 representation. SUN would be the n by n representation. So T, in the case of SU2, is just the power matrices, right? 5 by 2. And if you take this trace for the polymatrices, then this is a half because of this factor of a half around there. Trace the polymatrices, the 2 by 2 matrices, so if we have this factor of half comes up twice here, but the trace gives you a factor of 2 because it's 2 by 2 matrix. For the Gell-Mann matrices for SU3, and we use the generators in that case for these Gell-Mann matrices divided by 2. And they were normalized to be sure that they satisfy the safe graph. That's kind of how the normalization was chosen. So that's convention. If in that convention, you know, the gauge fields themselves are in the adjoint representation, so then C for the adjoint representation, which is n for SUN. So once I told you what it is for one representation, you figure out what it is for all the other representations. So it's I need to plug that to give you the answer. So in that case, if we now go through and calculate, if we had calculated this as we have been doing, but also for a non-abelian gauge field, we've got gauge fields that go around the loop. And we can have also a vertex where there's a 4-point gauge field vertex that you could have. And principle is also turns out the vertex where you have what's called a ghost. So call that. We added those things all up, but did the same kind of calculation as before. What you find is that so mu decoupling to mu would be, that's what I call beta g. And that's I'm using the same definition as I was using before. It's minus. Oh, sorry. I'm going to do things a little bit differently. I'm going to use g squared as the common defining of beta function. So it's just you just use the chain rule to figure out what is the g. It's g to the fourth. Over 2 to pi squared 11/3 times c in the adjoint representation minus 2/3 times the sum over all the fermions in the problem c for the representation of those fermions. So this is always there because the gauge fields themselves are in the adjoint representation. So all this stuff is giving you this. And this is a generalization of what I did over there. We had an answer which depended on the electric charge squared. That becomes, in the non-abelian case, just this combination of trace of two charges together. And that's where this is coming from. And so in that case of, say, SU3 color for the standard model, we'd be summing over all the different quarks, and they're all fundamental representations, so this would be a half for all of them. in fields in the fundamental. Sum over f, c of f would be n over 2. Because it's 1/2 for each fundamental in the zone. And this, for SUN, is going to be n, because that's the gauge fields. They're always in the adjunct region for SUN. You have to make up opposite sign. So if I've done this right, there's a positive sign here. That should be what we had over here, right? So for electromagnetism, we had just the fermions, so that was positive. You see that the sign changes. The gauge fields tend to make things go the opposite way. So this charge went up when the scale went up. In terms of our picture there, in terms of distance, as it went to smaller distances, that for small distances corresponds to large mu, the charge we were getting was larger and larger and larger, the way we were doing it. And that says that for a fixed charge on the outside, as you bring this scale in, there's less and less charge on the inside to screen the difference between charge, the bare charge, and the charge of C affinity. So this corresponds to screening. That's what we were seeing in electromagnetism. That if this is a positive charge, all the negative charges that are attracted to it, as you make the scale get smaller, you're excluding more and more negative charges. So you're getting a larger positive charge. So the larger you make the circle, the more these things would successfully screen this thing. And so the smaller you make the circle, the larger the effective charges you're seeing, because they're screening less and less. So physically, this sign corresponds to screening of charge. The gauge fields are doing the opposite thing. Instead of hiding the charge, the gauge fields are making the charge bigger. And that's the way to think about that is that that's like gravity. If you have gravity, the analog of charge is mass. And so if you have a mass, then the gravitational field itself has an energy, and that also gravitates. So you get more gravity for your buck for a given mass because the gravitational field that you've set up, which is the effects of the that's the analog of the gauge fields that you're setting up from a given color source. They were amplifying the charge you had because they're contributing to the charge that you're seeing from infinity. Oppositely from the fermions, which are hiding the charge you see from infinity. And that's kind of the source of this relative sign you're getting this and this. So who wins depends on how many fermions you have. It could be this 11/3 compared to the 2/3 means that the spin 1 particles will like to win. But if you have enough fermions, they can eventually win. And so the case where, if I call this the square bracket, so when square bracket is positive, then mu increasing implies that g decreases. And when square bracket is negative, mu increasing implies that g increases. This is called asymptotic freedom. Because it means that the smaller and smaller you look at things, the more microscopically you look at things, the more weakly coupled they are, so the simpler they are. And this is, I don't know if that had a name, that was asymptotic slavery, or infrared slavery. It's not supporting the name. That's the case of electromagnetism, where the smaller you look at, the bigger the charge had to be, given that you were no longer screening things. And for QCD, so in the standard model, the SU2 across SU3, both of those couplings are in this case, because for both of them, this beats this. But for the U1, the gauge fields never couple to themselves in U1, so they only get contributions from the fermions, so that's in this case. So if you were to plot the couplings, the SU2 and the SU3 couplings are getting smaller as you get to larger scales, and the U1 coupling is getting bigger. And the SC3 is changing faster because this is bigger for SC3 than it is for SC2. So if you plot against mu what these couplings do, typically people plot 1 over g squared because that's the thing that goes like a logarithm. What happens is that if g is decreasing for SC3 and SC2, that means 1 over g squared is increasing. So SC3 does something like that in the log plot. SC3. It starts off with a larger value for g, that means that 1 over g squared is smaller. And SE2 does something like that. And then, you know, two lines head across. It's irresistible to ask about the other one, what it does. And it does something like that. For a while, people thought it crossed, but it doesn't really. using just the standard amount of particles. But if you include, one of the things that excites people with supersymmetry is that if you include particles that supersymmetry predicts in addition to the standard amount of ones, it changes this relative balance. And what you get instead is something like that, where they do cross. And if they cross, that makes it sound like they could all have been the same and simple at some higher energy. That's kind of one of the motivations for granting unification. But the main thing is that the U1 is getting stronger as you go to larger values, and the other ones are getting weaker at different rates because of these relative interplay coefficients. And now I've been waiting long to do this. That was the last of the loop that we can do for you, unless you actually have something that you want to ask about. So think about questions until after. This is a good place to switch to PCB. And before I forget, next week there's no class. I forgot when I told you the rest of the term I'm here. But, what I meant was, except for next week.